members of the public. Where we will begin is to request, before you make your presentation on the budget and annual performance plan for 2017-2018, is to request the head of the SIU to do introduction. Over to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, honorable members. I'm the head of SIU. My name is Lekhoa Mutimi. On my right is Mrs. Sifura Mungalo. She's the acting communications manager. On my left is Mr. Andre Khanat. Is our CFO, and next to Andre Khanat is Gerard Fisahi, who you're probably all familiar with. He's heading our civil litigation section. Next to Gerard is our head of risk. Tulani Mukongo is the head of risk. Next to Tulani is probably a colleague that needs really introduction. Tulani has attended before, he tells me. Next to Tulani is Miss Nadrin Pando. She attends for the first today. She's the head of communications and stakeholder management. Next to Nadrin is Mrs. Maria Nyati. She's our head of business support. And next to Maria is Mr. Leonard Lekheto. He's our project director. He oversees the investigations in NIU. That's the team, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You may proceed with the presentation of the budget and annual report and not the comments for 2017-2018.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair, once more. Honorable members, our presentation contents appear on slide 2 and 3. It's going to be covered in terms of those categories, being the introduction, legislative mandate, regulatory framework, and then we give the committee our strategic overview. And then we've got our focus on operations, which is our program 2. And then we will focus on the financials, which our CFO will take us through. And then we've got a focus on administration, which is our enabling functions, support services, as they would be called, which is our problem 1, and then we conclude. Moving on to slide number 4, this is really just an intro to say we have reached the APP and the strategy document that was to the members after the session, and the highlights of the changes really include revising operations targets for 2017-2018, reviewing our mission, vision, values, goals, and strategic objectives, and introduce for the support services. Previously, the support services were not included, which meant that we would really not have been focusing on them in terms of measuring whatever key performance areas from their side. And we've submitted the APP and the strategic plan to the Department of Justice. Slide number 6. first and foremost, we derive our mandate from our enabling legislation, with the major functions being obviously to investigate corruption, malpractice, and maladministration. We have, as it will become evident as we go through, that we have really ensured that we also, you know, lift up the bar in terms of civil litigation. In terms of our powers, we've got, you know, the various powers that enable us to investigate, which includes subpoena, search and seizure, and we also interview or interrogate witnesses under oath. I've already mentioned the issue around the civil litigation to recover lost funds. And obviously on completion, we then issue our report, the final report, to the state president. The next slide deals with the regulatory framework. We refer there to the Constitution and the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act, PFMA, which is our main financial and organizational management legislation. We did a lot with FICA and also the Prevention of Organized Crime Act. That's but amongst other legislation that we really implement in our operation. I'd like to take the committee then through our vision and mission that underpins the strategy that we have now adopted. We reviewed this at our last strategic session. The vision that we espouse is that we would like to position SIU as a state-preferred and trusted forensic investigation and litigation agency. That vision emanates from the point of view that we would like state institutions, wherever there is a need to institute forensic investigations and the related litigation service, they should first and foremost, top of mind, have SIU in mind and refer. That would will go a long way in terms of saving the funds of state where referrals are made to private forensic investigations. Indeed, there's work that has to be done to achieve that vision, and we will come to that. In terms of our mission, that really also spans from the vision, is that we are a state-preferred provider of forensic investigating and litigation services, working together with other agencies in the fight to eradicate corruption, malpractice, and maladministration from society. As I indicated, Chair, that to achieve this vision, if we are to position SIU as a preferred provider of forensic litigation by state institutions, and we're talking at all levels of state, then there's building blocks that has to be in place, and we have already started on the journey to that. Amongst others, it's the amendment or proposed amendments to the legislation that enables SIU, which is the SIU Act. In the main, we would like to address areas that would enable speed of service. What do I mean by that? At the inception, if an accounting authority or an accounting officer refers a matter to SIU, the expectation is that we have to turn around the situation as quickly as is possible than is the case now. So we're dealing there with areas of pre-proclamation investigation, which is at the moment a bit hamstrung. So we would like to, amongst others, you know, deal with that in the proposed amendments. We would also like to deal with the funding model. We'll come to that later on, which we are of the view that there's an opportunity to improve on that model. So that's amongst others what we would like to do with that area. And those amendments, as members may probably have a question on, they're underway. We're still discussing the proposed amendments with the Department of Justice. They will obviously land on this committee at an appropriate time. I've, on the right-hand side top, I've indicated the pre-proclamation stage, which at the moment is an issue. I've indicated before in this committee that part of what happened is that the activities of at pre-proclamation stage, they do attract costs, and those costs were at some point, you know, pronounced as irregular, simply because our legislation doesn't provide for that. So we'd like to set that record straight. And during the pre-proclamation stage, we cannot really use the powers that are vested on us by, you know, the SIU Act in terms of subpoenas and so on, because the Act envisages that we only commence the investigation once we receive the proclamation. So we'd like to really improve that stage. I've already referred to the funding model, and later on in the presentation, Chair, I will be touching on the turnaround time to process proclamation and complete the quality investigation. On the next slide, these are the values that underpin our organization. As we do our work, we would like to do it obviously with the integrity that it's deserving. We also would like to foster cooperation as we operate within the multi-agency approach. We also want to foster teamwork as we do multidisciplinary investigations. Professionalism is one of the values that we espouse. Efficiency, independence, drive, and passion. We would like to ensure that we stick to those values without failure. I'll move over to the next slide here, which is about the strategic goals. Members would have read in our strategy document that we've got in the main two goals that we mentioned there, which is the effective and efficient organizational management. That's goal one. In the main, that program or the goal is really to ensure that the organization functions well. We'll talk to that later on. As you can see there, in terms of the objectives, the focus is to ensure cooperation and partnership among stakeholders through ongoing engagement, and that process has already started. We had a very successful stakeholder relations management in the Northwest Province with the Northwest government, and we are already seeing the spin-offs of that in terms of investigation. We'd like to ensure that we've got an effective ICT enabling environment, and also to effectively and efficiently manage the financial resources of SIU. And I did indicate that we'd like to improve on the effectiveness and efficiency of organizational management. On the extreme right is really key value drivers in terms of sound governance and oversight, teamwork and collaboration, role clarity and accountability, effective internal processes, systems and control. We do emphasize on ICT enablement, effective resourcing and sound human resources and management practices. I'll still come back to the human resources part. Later on, I'll be telling the committee around the organizational review that we will be undertaking in due course. Goal number two focuses on our core business, and the core business being ready to ensure that we investigate corruption, maladministration, and facilitate or initiate appropriate remedial action. On that one, Chair, in terms of our strategic objectives, we'd like to conduct quality forensic investigations, facilitate or initiate appropriate remedial action, and to cooperate effectively with other role players. In terms of key value drivers, we emphasize expeditious processing and finalizing of proclamations. This is an issue that I'll come back to in terms of ensuring that we improve our turnaround times. We'd like to also improve on our research and development space, research on relevant topics to support investigation teams, high quality and consistent decisions. We'd like to do our work on a cost-effective basis in terms of forensic investigations. I've already mentioned around technology. We are really looking forward to enabled technology environment which enables our processes and our delivery channels. Expeditious and finalizing of matters with clear direction as regards to remedial action to be taken. I'd like to also just indicate that we will be also be focusing on effective data analytics. We'll come back to that. Chairperson, if I move over to the next slide on key assumptions, it's 4.5. As we develop our strategy, we have made key assumptions, and amongst others are that we will finalize the organizational review in this year, 17-18. Organizational review is key for us. That review is going to enable us to improve our structural effectiveness, process effectiveness, and also look at people. We have assumed that we will be able to appoint relevant key personnel following that organizational review. The one assumption which is also key to our operation is that the state institutions will honor the SIU invoices once we have completed our investigations or as and when we submit the invoices following on the targets that we have completed. We've also assumed that to enable our strategy, we will pursue the legislative amendments that I have referred to and that they will be passed following due process. We want to improve our data analytics and serve as a central repository for corruption data, malpractices data, and maladministration data. By so doing, we will then be able to support the state institutions in terms of controls improvement so that they can improve their risk management around these areas. We thought it appropriate that as we move on the strategy implementation that we point out some of the challenges that we face. But as we face those challenges, we ensure that we've got processes in place to deal or mitigate those challenges. Currently, the organizational structure, we have the view that it's not optimized, but as I indicated, that we will be starting with the organizational review project. The supply chain management process is almost at a final stage. My expectation is that by the end of this week or early next week, we should be able to have finality on that process. Operational effectiveness with regard to turnaround times on investigations can be improved. That's one of the challenges, Chair, and we are really working hard to ensure that we improve our investigation turnaround times. Those would be supported, amongst others, by streamlined and defined standard operating procedures. Operational effectiveness in the supply chain management space, we have found that that space also requires some improvement to ensure that it supports the business appropriately. There are key pockets of specialized operational excellence that needs to be strengthened. Those are the areas such as data analytics space, and I would also say cyber forensic space that will also require improvement. I've mentioned, Chair, that the current model to recover fees for investigation, it's really not working as effective. But we have already started the process to ensure that we improve in this space. Amongst others, we'd like to include it in our proposed legislative amendment. But before that takes effect or before it's processed, there's current activities, and the CFO will probably also mention that later on, is that we have engaged the National Treasury. The last time we came here, we said we are engaging the National Treasury. There has been some process in that space. Treasury has sort of worked with us. They will also be sending reminders, in codes, sort of letters of demand, so to speak, demanding for the state institutions to pay the fees. We have also, on our part, went out and wrote, letters to the state institutions whose time has passed in terms of payments, and we have seen some, but the non-payment is still a worry. We will continue to pursue that. Next slide, Chair. It is our duty to ensure that as we pursue our work, we ensure that part of the national development plan that applies to our environment, we contribute to that, so that ultimately government is able to achieve the objectives of the national development plan. That slide that you're looking at really ensures that we are aligned with the chapter in the NDP that deals with the fight against corruption. Just in brief, we share the vision to fully commit and contribute to the goals of the NDP, obviously through our effective investigation of cases and sound governance and fraud management. In the last, one of the last meetings, the chairperson did ask a specific question in terms of what we're doing relating to youth unemployment. We later on, Chair, will be talking about some of the mentorship or internship programs that we have put ourselves to do to alleviate youth unemployment, to contribute to the alleviation of youth unemployment. The public access and the provision of redress, we continuously ensure that the public is aware, and we, on the communication side, you will see when we deal with that specific goal, that we would like to now raise awareness and education onto our people to ensure that they are aware of the role and mandate of the Special Investigating Unit. I earlier on referred to the stakeholder relations event that we had with the Northwest government. That was really just a start. We'll be doing those in various provinces. But we have seen the value add in terms of our people becoming aware. I was featured on one of the radio stations where the public called in and how appreciative they were in understanding that what SIU is about. We have really found that to be quite effective. Chair, as we do our work, we ensure that we are aligned to the Department of Justice theme, simply because Department of Justice is the department that administratively plays an oversight role. We ensure that we align to some of the themes that on slide on the slide that you're looking at, slide 15, alignment to DOJ themes. When they presented to this committee, they spelled out various themes that they were pursuing. This included the transformation of legal practice and mechanisms for access to all for justice. We really applied our mind in terms of, you know, how is it that we can play a role in that? And part of what we do as we propose the amendments to our legislation, we'll look at that. In our space, in the civil litigation space, but also in the corporate litigation space, we do continue to brief counsels, we brief legal practitioners. We would like to ensure that our briefing patterns also change to enable the transformation goals, such that we deliberately brief the legal practitioners who were previously looked over. To be specific, we would like to ensure that black legal practitioners also receive the briefings. Chair, you'll know that we work through the state attorney, but as we interact with the state attorney, we would like to continuously ensure that this is taken into consideration and those briefing patterns reflect our views. Transformation of state legal services, that's the second theme. We also in this ensure that we strengthen litigation function, cases presented and finalized appropriately in court, and then we'll also ensure that the amounts recovered for the state is through due process. The transformation of the criminal justice system and restoring public confidence. In terms of restoring public confidence in our work, or SIU in particular, or generally the criminal justice system or the justice system, is to ensure that we continuously show the results to our public. We continuously indicate and demonstrate that we follow our work and investigate effectively, and continuously educate them in terms of the impact that our work is producing. We mentioned there in terms of the processes that we do, ensuring that we protect whistleblowers, and also leading the facilitation on the national anti-corruption strategy. Chairperson, we play a very important role in the development, and now it's going to be really the rollout and the public participation in the implementation of the national strategy. The national anti-corruption strategy is championed from the Department of Monitoring and Evaluation. So very soon, I'm sure the members will obviously be informed that we will be launching the national anti-corruption strategy, which is championed by the minister and the presidency. The next slide still goes on around the alignment with the programs of the Department of Justice. On the program one, which is administration, which is really more around our enablement and ensuring that our organization work functions properly, we would like to continuously maintain and improve on our audit opinion. We want an effective audit and risk committee. We would like to also update on the financial policies and standards. On the program two, on the justice side, which is court services, we would like to pursue the re-establishment of the special tribunal chair. On the legal services, I did already allude to that, strengthening of our litigation functions, amendments to our act, and plans to undertake anti-corruption research. On the program five, we'd like to ensure that we enable ourselves in terms of the effective case management. The next slide, which is then the transformation agenda. I've already touched on the supply chain management, which requires improvement. We'll ensure that we continuously pursue our employment equity goals. as already mentioned, around the briefing patterns. We'd like to make sure that the learnerships and internships, this is where I indicated, that we'd like to play a role in ensuring that we contribute to the youth unemployment. We'll also introduce appropriate mentorships. We're going to, as we do the organizational review, continuously ensure that we do culture review to ensure that we've got a performance culture in our organization and improve on the performance management framework. Chair, the next slide introduces us to the operations part of our strategy. And similarly, when we looked at our operations, we had a few assumptions that we did similar to our overall strategy. For SIU to function effectively, we have assumed and achieved its targets. Increased awareness, public awareness and education is going to be one of the key drivers that we have to drive. we anticipate that the proclamations may increase in number in this year. Why are we saying that? It's because as we drive public awareness, as we drive stakeholder relations management, the public becomes more aware and they're able to access our services and report the matters to us. So we would like to ensure that we improve on our turnaround times for investigations and civil litigation. We want to finalize some of the memorandum of understandings with key stakeholders. And that, Chair, now takes me to to the slide that shows the targets for the next year. You'll see, Chair, that the target lines have not really changed. They're still similar to the target lines that we had for the last financial year. The number of investigations closed out under a published proclamation, they go up from last year to this year, 800 to 1,000. I need to also pause here and indicate that within each proclamation, you have quite a number of investigations. So you may find that within one proclamation, we've got plus minus, let's say, 100 or 80 investigations that you have to look at per specific item. One proclamation may probably have various conflicts of interest per officials, which has to be investigated individually. They may have various corruption areas that need to be investigated. So as we investigate on the overall proclamation, we do focus on quite a number of investigations that we close out. So that number indicates to those specific individual investigations within the proclamation. And Chair, the next one is the number of reports submitted to the President. That number increases from 5 to 8, and it on first sight it may seem like it's really not quite an increase or a steep increase, but we have taken into account that to finalize all of those and if you look back if you compare with the previous performance, it's been really averaging around that number. And we do not want to sort of put the number that would ultimately call it not achieved, but also we want to be realistic and ensure that we deliver quality reports. And I need to also pause here and explain that, and I've said it before in the committee, Chair, that at the time when we submit the report, it does not mean that the actions that were required to be taken have stalled or have been put on hold, members would know. But if we, during the investigation, if there is any finding that points to any one of the officials having been guilty of a criminal offense, we do take that evidence that we have put up, we refer it according to our legislation, we refer it to the NPA. And the NPA takes it forward in terms of their prosecution. So we act instantly when the evidence points to criminal action. Similarly, when the evidence points to misconduct of any official, and there's a requirement for state institutions to take disciplinary action, we do not wait until the final report. I think this is very important to emphasize. We refer the evidence pointing to misconduct to the state institution and ensure that it's referred and the accounting authority is required to take action. The other leg is around the civil litigation. It's the same principle. We do not wait where there is a need in case there's a finding that any of the investigation that we go through, be it pointing to an irregular contract or any of the losses that the state may have suffered, we do package the civil litigation, and I did say we work through the state attorney to ensure that we appoint the legal practitioners, be it attorney or counsel, to ensure that we pursue that matter. So at the time of the report, all of those actions would have been referred appropriately. I did indicate previously that we are streamlining measures with the state institutions to ensure that we follow up on these referrals. But I just wanted to make that point here. The next indicators, you'll see that there's a downward trend there, and the question would be, you know, why is it that we're revising the indicators down? The money or assets potentially recoverable goes down from 240 to 200. The actual value of money or assets recovered from 140 to 120. Chair, on this one, and I've been very vocal with my team members, that part of what, I mean, all of the indicators are very important, and I'll come to the others. Part of what we have to make sure and drive hard is to recover the monies lost from the state and ensure that we recover them for the state institutions. But if you look back at the performance of the institution, we gradually ensuring that we develop a realistic number. If you look at the average performance in the past years, the 200 and the 120, it's still very steep. And you'll see in the next slide which shows the current performance. and again, it's simply because the profile of the investigations compared to the previous profiles that we got, there's an example that we use in one of the slides, that we used to investigate a SASA matter, which had various investigations, and we were able to make quite a number of recoveries from those beneficiaries who were not befitting. I think this is that's the rationale, that we are wanting to make sure that the targets that we put are really realistic. The next target is the value of potential loss prevented, rises from 18 to 21. Value of contracts or administrative action set aside from 600 to 660. the value of matters in respect of which evidence was referred. I've already referred to that, from 1.2 to 1.3 billion. A number of referrals made to the relevant prosecuting authority, 60 to 75. Number of referrals made for disciplinary executive administrative action, that from 75, it still sort of remains at 75. The next slide here, you'll see I really don't touch on 1819 and 1920, but we have reflected them. I focus on the 1718 performance check. The next slide, we put it simply because there was a request, as we were invited, to show quarter four performance, but we have now put this slide just as an indication of where we are. As you know, that these figures, this is preliminary figures, they still need to be audited. At the next appearance, we will be focusing on the performance. But you can see, Chair, the only red that shows that we didn't meet the targets, it's around the targets that I was referring to, the ones that have been revised down. The value of money and assets potentially recoverable. You can see there that the target annual target is 240, and we have not made that target simply because we have found it that it's a steep target, and the analysis that went into it was informed by the kind of cases that we had before, whereas the profile of cases has since changed. It's similar to the actual value of our money or assets recovered. I think we've sort of in the past, being intent on ensuring that we recover, but we had not really looked intensively on the how realistic is this figure given the work at hand that we are likely to achieve. And Chair, I'm not touching on all of the other target lines which have been achieved. The next slide just really indicates. We've put it here simply because our focus, amongst others, although we do want to drive hard on the recoveries, but I think it's also very critical to ensure that we focus more on the prevention side. And the prevention side would be along those lines where the contracts are set aside. We do not allow the contract that's irregular to run its course. And the figure that you see in there is the figure that's indicative, and again, it still needs to be audited, but it's indicative that in that line of prevented contracts and or administrative actions set aside, there's an indication that SIU has saved the fiscus or the state institutions more than 3 billion, which is a very significant amount. So this is really as against being now the need to pursue it in terms of recovery. But I think we're just making that statement that we will continuously focus on the prevention side and ensure that we save state institutions the money. Chair, the next slide. It's really in brief. What we've done is to do a root cause analysis in terms of the why is it that we have really not made the two targets that we've reflected. Part of what was taken into account is the recoveries that we do together with AFU, if you look at the extreme left. Currently, there's a number, and we've quantified a number of about 300 million which, if the AFU process had gone its course, we would have, would probably have made, you know, some serious improvement on the two targets that you see in red. But because there is an appeal, there's an appeal case that challenges some of the mechanisms or processes in the asset forfeiture unit space, or asset forfeiture space. That appeal has cost us to put about 300 million on hold, pending that appeal. So that's one of the areas that that we want to just indicate. The delays in finalizing the civil matters, and in particular the just and equitable leg of our civil matters, that has also sort of made a contribution. I've indicated the change in the profile of investigation, you know, referring previously to the SASA and I think we've got land reform there. That had quite a number of matters that we previously, SIU was able to close and recover monies. So those were really the main highlights in terms of the good cost analysis of how is it that, you know, we can improve. On the AFU side, we're really waiting to see how the appeal will unfold. I have contacted the NPA before this meeting, just to be able to see if I can get highlights of where the appeal is. I've arranged that I will meet with the NDPP next week or week after to ensure that from my side I understand where the appeal process is. At the moment, I do not have tangible information in terms of where the appeal process is. If there's a need, we can update the committee once we have established where the process is. In terms of delays in finalizing just the equitable matter or civil matters in general, part of what we will talk about, Chair, is that we would like to push, we'd like to push with the re-establishment of the special tribunal, and we've got information in terms of where we are with that. So the next slide, without going through them line by line, it's still on the root cause. But in the main, the slide that's before you, which is slide 24, under the value of this of the potential recoveries, these, as I indicated, the sources of those recoveries would have been, if you look in the middle of the slide, the SASA investigation, we had a whole lot of acknowledgement of debt that were honored and paid during that time of the SASA investigation. You know, this was one of those, you know, investigations that gave us a lot of recoveries. The next bullet point is DPW leases. It's also around acknowledgement of debt, which are timed, and ensure that we follow up and they're paid. We had a Department of Transport investigation that gave us, you know, acknowledgement of liabilities which would be paid in a lump sum. The next slide, Chair, also deals with, you know, we really wanted the committee to comprehend the root causes in terms of this areas. I indicate there that we would have restraint of orders in terms of AFU, but I've already indicated the challenges there. In terms of the civil orders on the just and equitable leg, I've already mentioned that. We would have settlement agreements and compensation orders that come out at times through the, you know, criminal procedure process. And we would also indicate, amongst others, where there have been VAT fraud, and South African Revenue Service is able to get those monies back. On the indicator of actual actual value of money or asset recovered. This is the actual money that's in the bank, but the sources of money are similar. If you look at all those bullet points here, and I wouldn't want to waste the committee's time and go through them again. They refer to acknowledgement of debt, acknowledgement of liabilities, and the AFU process. With your permission, Chair, I'll move over then to update on the civil litigation. We have put this information in this pack before, and all of these matters are public knowledge. They are in court. I need to just make an overall statement, Chair, on this matter, that you will see that the big pick on the first one. You'll see that the line there that says pleadings have closed, the SIU served its discovery affidavit. The next step is the pre-trial conference where after the matter will go to trial. Okay. And the next one is really still around the process where the pleadings have not yet closed. The next one, it's that on this one at least, the court has already found that the award of the contract is irregular. But we don't only end there. Once the court has found that the contract is irregular, we have then the next leg, which is the just and equitable. This is how the civil process can really unfold and take a while. And hence our call or our pursuit to re-establish the special tribunal. Chair, the next cases. Chair, if you want me to, I'll go through them one by one. But it's really just to update the committee in terms of where we are with the civil matters. Most of them, we are waiting the civil date, the court hearing date. Some of them, the pleadings are still being exchanged and so on. But we thought it appropriate that we should...
Is noted.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. If there are questions, obviously we will take them. Chair, then I take the committee to slide 31, which is around the re-establishment of the special tribunal. I'm aware that at the last appearance, we did mention this point. Since the last appearance, I personally have been in contact with the Department of Justice, and the Department of Justice has really pushed the process forward. The infrastructure is in place of the special tribunal that used to be operational previously in the Eastern Cape. We would like to make sure that we use that infrastructure. Department of Justice has also helped that they would also identify other areas. But where we are at the moment is that the Department of Justice, once they have determined all these infrastructure requirements, what's required in terms of the legislation is that the judge president of the tribunal has to be appointed. And the judge president is appointed by the president. And there's already, I think, a nomination process that has started. The expectation is that Department of Justice would probably by now have sent the nomination to the presidency for appointment of the judge president. And the judge president would then appoint the other judges. We have had the opportunity to engage with some of the judge presidents in the provinces, just to understand how is it that they view this process. Part of what they indicated was that they would not want the judges that they nominate to the special tribunal to sort of prejudice their normal court role. But then we will have a mechanism where if a judge is nominated from the current judges, that we put it in the calendar of the court, so that we know that this week is probably the civil tribunal sitting, and the judge will know upfront, so that the registrar or the clerk of the court, they can schedule their court roles appropriately to ensure that you know, we don't prejudice the court roles as the court would envisage. Chair, the last line there, we would like to make sure that we re-establish this in this financial year. I think it's really a typo, and apologies for that. It's this financial year, 17-18, and beyond. So we do not want to really waste more time. We will continue to follow up with the Department of Justice to ensure that they assist us in this process. Chair, the next slide deals with some of the proposed amendments that we would like to incorporate in the SIU Act. We would like a clear legislative mandate to conduct pre-proclamation investigations, which would then obviously lead to the motivations for new proclamations. Without belaboring the point, I think I've already touched on the rationale for that. We would like, even in the pre-proclamation space, we would still want to make use of the powers that are vested on SIU by the legislation. At the moment, when we get an allegation from anywhere, whistleblower, state institution, we would like to assess the allegations. We would like to make sure that the allegations are warrant a motivation. That process and the costs related are really at the moment at risk of being classified as irregular, but we've already engaged with the Auditor General in this regard. And then another key aspect is the changes to the model for the recovery fees. Like in all other areas that we've said, that the portfolio committee will probably, you know, add on some thought on that, and the legislation will obviously serve here whenever it's ready. Chair, I did make a point around the improvement of our investigation turnaround times. This is something that we'd like to address. We know everywhere. State institutions are visited. Everywhere we start the engagement, I am confronted with this point that we would like to see improvements in the turnaround times. We've said this before. Previously, the proclamations that were put together were quite wide and generic and not focused. We'd like to make sure that we change that approach, so that it's sort of target-based. The new strategy is to obtain the proclamation that are as specific as possible, where matters will only be investigated that relate directly to the allegations that have been received. You know? Not widely, and you know, keep on receiving allegations even during the investigation and not close the matter. For long, multi-year running proclamations, we would like to produce interim reports, which will be submitted to the President, and ensure that we have closed a particular aspect of that investigation. And in that way, the state institutions that we are investigating on behalf of, they will also be at ease and find that you know, we've produced a report, but we are also able to update them in terms of the outcomes. And then this feeds to the query that they always make, that you know, we are expected to pay, but we don't see sort of the outcomes. We have taken, you know, a decision to give them particular updates, you know, when it relates to outcomes of the investigations. The final reports would obviously then be submitted to the President. Operationally, we have introduced project reviews. During the project reviews, my expectation is that each and every program manager would then indicate where they are with any investigations, what are the hurdles, when is the investigations scheduled to be closed. I take into account that this is not a measure that would bring unnecessary pressure to the investigations and then compromise on the quality of investigation. We do not at all want to compromise on the investigations. But these are just amongst others, from effective project management to monitoring and ensuring that we turn around our investigations as quickly as possible. Chair, with your permission, the next slide introduces the financials, which there's quite a number of information in the slides, but with your permission, I would like to hand over to our Chief Financial Officer just to run the committee through the key areas of those slides. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. As the HOU has mentioned, I will concentrate on a few slides. I'm not going to bore you with the tables, the extended tables of figures. I'm sure you're quite used to it. On slide 35, the underpinning assumptions that we've used in order to draw the MTA figures over the three-year period. The first one is, whilst we're busy with, and we're going to go into an organizational review process, the compensation of employees has been determined in line with the proposed organizational structure as it is presented in the APP. Provision has been made for growth in certain areas in the operational space where we want to build capacity. Over the three-year period, from a staff complement of 581 up to 634 in the 1920 financial year, the average increase in cost of compensation to employees that is aligned with the National Treasury guidelines is 9% per annum over the three-year period. And then for goods and services, the average increase is 7.1%. If we go to the next slide, it really shows just the alignment of the average growth that we're anticipating in income, which is then a weighted average of 8.9%. And similarly, at the bottom slide, the total expenditure consisting out of the HR, the compensation of employees, which is the biggest portion, and the goods and services, also 8.9%. So the growth patterns are the same in both the case of the income and the expenses. On slide 37, we'll just pause and concentrate on the 2017-18 column there. You would see a figure there, sale of goods and services, 200 million, 201 million. That is the figure that we are recovering in terms of Section 5 of the SIU Act. So when we do an investigation, we scope the project, then we apply rates and number of resources, and we will, on a monthly basis, we will invoice that figure there. That comprises around about 36% of our total income. You will see that we do still get a government grant of 346 million. The issue on the 200 million, the income that we invoice, comes back to the issue of, whilst we're invoicing, we're not being paid for it, and we'll come back to that. Total expenses then for the year, as I've indicated, 562 million. You will see for the 2017-18 year, the figure on the capital expenditure is a bit higher, and I'll highlight in the further slides how it's composed, the composition of that capital expenditure. Slide 38 then, the split of the compensation of employees, 74%, 418 million, and goods and services, which is mainly leases of premises and administrative expenditure, traveling and subsistence, 144 million. When we then come to the capital expenditure, the makeup of the 60 million, you will see there the biggest portion, which is the blue, is 47%, is 28 million allocated towards ICT, case management, and a related system. I think that it's quite important. Currently, We don't have an integrated core operation system. So when basically an allegation in a case comes in, it is treated manually through the various steps in the value chain of investigation and moving on to civil litigation, and we envisage a totally integrated system that is completely paperless, so that we also ensure that we don't lose any documents. We are busy specifying the user requirements for that system, and we will be going through a supply chain management process. The bigger, you'll see there's been also a related hardware of about 15 million that we're planning, so that would be a renewal of the current ICT infrastructure. The current infrastructure is quite old, it has not been renewed for a number of years. The leasehold improvements would be related to leases, new leases that we would acquire during the year. We are going on a procurement process to renew our head office lease, the Polokwane, the Cape Town, and the Durban offices. And the leasehold improvements would be the improvements, you know, like partitioning and office, a general office equipment, together with the office equipment and the furniture. Okay. The split to the two programs, we have two programs, which is essentially the operations program, and 66% of our budget is allocated towards that. That is our core operations, and then 34% is allocated towards the administration program, which is the support functions, consisting of IT, HR, finance, internal audit, risk department, and internal integrity unit departments, and then the ExCo complement. Chair, the next slide, I've already touched on the income, but just to mention on slide 41 that the project income over the MTF period is envisaged to increase from a total actual that we've invoiced of 163 million for 2016-17 up to 234 million in the 2019-20 financial year. 42 I've already covered. The growth patterns, the capex on page 43 I've covered. The split per program, just a graphical illustration, 367 million then being the investigations or the operational space, and then 195 million towards the administrative program. Slide 45 is just the detail of that, of the administration program, and the next slide is the detail on the operational program. Slide 47 shows the outstanding debtors, the main issue currently, if you look at the balance sheet of the SIU. You'll see at the end of November, end of February and end of March, the outstanding debts are depicted. At year end, our provisional figure of 418 million is currently outstanding. 418 million, quite a huge figure. And the alarming factor is that 85% of that, 356 million is more than 90 days. We've really been, on the next two slides, we're highlighting what we've been doing. In January, we've written physical letters to all 43 state institutions that owes us money, to the chief executive officers or the accounting officers, if it's a board, also to the CFOs. We've engaged National Treasury last year in October, and then just before year-end in this year, we've engaged again, and we've agreed on two main actions there. First of all, on the current debt, the 418 million, the National Treasury will also assist in sending letters physically to all accounting officers, authorities, and CFOs to again remind them to pay the outstanding SIU debt. But Chair and members, I think more importantly, we have come to a realization that the current model is simply not working effectively. And Treasury, we've had a meeting with the Deputy DG and his team, and we are going to go into workshops to try and devise a process or a mechanism whereby we centrally pool funds and that we invoice that on a centralized basis. In other words, currently we're invoicing 43 state institutions, we could call it 50. The plan is as when we finalize the proclamation to draw up a project plan relating to that to cost it, and then for Treasury to pool their funds, centrally either with themselves or with the presidency. And when we invoice, we only deal then with one entity that will settle the invoice for us. And National Treasury has been accepting the fact that it's not working, and they're quite willing to look at a change in the business model. So over the medium term, over the next 3 to 5 years, we'll definitely pursue that, and it might lead to the legislative changes, which will come back to the committee and the processes. Then just further escalations, the head of the unit also had a meeting with the president on 17 February, where the president then called on all state institutions to settle their debt. And just before year-end again, there was also a meeting with, at that stage, our acting Minister of Justice, where the acting minister, we prepared the letters that she will send out to all the colleagues, and our minister will now send those letters out. They have not been sent out yet. It is in the process of being sent. Chair, that's really it on the financials.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think it's just key to indicate that the model that we are engaging Treasury on, it's still conceptual. Nothing concrete, and as the CFO says, we're still workshop the mechanism that we propose, and if it's acceptable, we'll then put it in document, and it will follow the process, and possibly also into the proposed legislative amendment. So at the moment, it's still a work in progress. I just really wanted to underpin that. Chair, the next slide, as I indicated when I started, that part of what we did when we're doing our strategy is to include the enabling functions, which are your support services, into the APP, so that we also can measure the support services on key areas. I mean, you would know that each business unit will still have their own operational plans, you know, their strategies, but these are the key ones that we have found it appropriate to include in the APP. And you would have noticed that as we go through these slides, there's annotations on the slides that refers to the relevant pages in the APP. So this first one that's in front of you, I won't go through it line by line, but we have ensured that the human resource indicator also is in the APP with those goals that are reflected there. Simply because from a human capital perspective, we would like to make sure that we give it appropriate focus. So, Chair, taking that the committee we have noted that human resource slide, I'll then move to the next slide. I did indicate that we will be embarking on various programs and mentorships. That slide 52 indicates, you know, some of the mentorship programs that we will be embarking on around our forensic lawyers, forensic investigators. I will also be embarking on various internships just to ensure that we advocate youth unemployment. There's also other programs that we do offer. And the next two slides, Chair, just really indicate the current headcount, racial mix, and where we are with our staffing levels. You'll see there on slide 53, our total staff as at 28 February was 523, split in operations and business support. That's how it's reflected on that slide. In terms of female and male, we've got 49% female, 51% male. The next slide gives the committee a picture of all the demographics in terms of headcount. I won't go through it line by finance, which is finance as a business unit now. We'd like to also make sure that we improve our financial management systems, and that slide indicates the goals that we have set ourselves in terms of the finance unit. Again, Chair, I take it that the committee would have noted that. We'll take questions on that. The next slide, 56, we would like to improve our information technology environment. We have done an analysis. We found that we really need to improve around our software, hardware, just general applications and infrastructure, just to ensure that we support our investigations appropriately. Again, Chair, with your permission, not going through it line by line, the slide really indicates that we would like to improve our information. The next slide focuses on communications. I did indicate that we'd like to measure ourselves in terms of the communications. This focuses on the awareness, education of the public in terms of the work that we do. So we'd like to ensure that we improve in that space. Chair, the next slide focuses on, as we do our strategy, our risk management landslide would probably decrease or change, then we want to make sure that we are aware of the risks that are attendant to our objectives. with your permission, Chair, we'll move on. The strategic risks are those risks that we have assessed and ensured that we understand those risks that will put us at risk of not achieving our objectives. We have listed those risks there. It's really just high or key risk areas. All those risks are embedded in the risk management plan of the organization. We have risk mitigation strategies, we've got controls that we have identified, we've got risk owners, and the risk committee and the audit committee are monitoring that risk management space. The last three slides, Chair, focus on our key deliverables for this year. We would like to make sure that we focus effectively on this process. This is the organizational review that we're going to embark on. We will be looking at the entire organizational structure and operating model, all governance and related structures, remuneration and retention strategy, performance management system, job descriptions with related KPIs, and career ladders of the various jobs. We'll also, as I have mentioned, we've also mentioned the staff, the culture survey that we would also be doing. As part of the organizational review, we'll also be reviewing the operating model, focusing on addressing human capital issues. I went across the organization, talking to staff, engaging trade unions, the recognized trade union. Part of what they raised with me or with us is that there's human capital issues that we need to look at, particularly around career ladders. Most of our forensic investigators indicate that they have been in those roles for years. They do not see movement. And they would like to see that there's opportunities that we can create. This is going to be really what occupies us to ensure that our staff feel that they are catered for. The last slide
indicate in terms of those key focus areas, putting our people first, growth through operational excellence. We would like to get the basics right, and we would like to stay relevant. So, Chair, there's going to be quite a lot of work that that we do in this year, and obviously, as we go by, we will update the committee in terms of the progress we are making. In conclusion, Chair, we'd like to indicate that our APP and the strategic plan took into account the guidance from the Department of Justice Ministry and the stakeholders that we have been engaging, and obviously we appreciate the input and guidance of the Portfolio Committee. I'd like to pause here and thank you, Chair. This is the presentation.
Thank you, Advocate Ntivi and team. I will now want to open for questions and comments from members. I will recognize Honorable Dennis Breitenbach, Honorable Swan, Honorable Maila, Honorable Matthias, Honorable Swart in that order, and to be followed by Honorable Bongo.
Thank you. Mr. Matiri, congratulations on your appointment. I haven't seen such an appointment, and thank you for the presentation. I have some other questions that I'd like to immediately move to the outstanding monies owed to the government department. And perhaps Mr. Khanan says the bulk of it is over 90 days. And 90 days sounds reasonably benign. I'm sure that it's much more than that. I'd like the actual outstanding debts. How old is this debt? We're talking months, years, weeks, days? I suspect we're talking years. If you could give me those figures, please. I think they much more accurately reflect the predicament that you find yourself in. So how long is this really? What is the breakdown? How much is owed in that breakdown? How much have you been able to successfully collect as opposed to what is owed over the same breakdown period? According to your own legislation, defaulting departments must work through treasury to obtain an exemption. Has this been done? Do they have the exemption? And if not, why not? And then obviously, that kind of outstanding debt, which is monumental, must have an operational impact on the unit. If you could go into a little more depth about that. Then, on page 2 of your presentation, it's not really on page 2, but you've missed some of your tasks, quite significant. I'd like you to, somebody to take us through the reasons for that. On the other hand, you've exceeded some of your tasks, if you have to add, but I'm more interested in the ones that you missed. The ones that you exceeded, well done, but the ones that you missed, I need to understand why you're missing them. So, for instance, the referrals to the prosecuting authority started at 16 and ended on 29. If the figures are wrong, you couldn't help them. So the targets missed, I'd like to understand why targets are being missed and why they're being adjusted downwards. It doesn't show a lot of confidence in your own narrative that you want to remain relevant and continue to make a contribution. If you're adjusting your targets downwards, I'd like to understand why. The position with the memorandum of understanding with the NPA and the DPCI, what is the position of the SMA? Has it been finalized? Is it in operation? And if so, are there any positive effects thereof? You've spent some time now, you've been with the SIU for some time now, you've had the opportunity to make your mark. You've had a strat planning session. How will the revision of the strat plan enhance the role of the SIU, just very briefly, and how do you expect it to allow you to meet your targets, even down graded one? I'm sure that my colleagues will cover the rest of the stuff. I have a whole range of other questions, but there's one more question that I have. You know, the ACCC really hasn't dazzled anyone with its brilliance, unfortunately. It's a huge body with a huge amount of supposed expertise, and you don't really see it making an enormous impact. Yet you say that you'd like to make a significant contribution to the work of the ACT. Bearing in mind that they haven't exactly knocked us out with their contribution, how do you propose to make a significant contribution? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Clayton. What's Honourable Collins?
Thank you, Chairperson. And let me, at the outset, say I think of all of the budgetary presentations we've received, what I think impressed in respect of the SIU is that they, to a large extent, I think preempted very well the issues that might be at play based on their performance, past performance, and the amendment to their targets. So I think, to be fair, a lot of the questions has been answered, although some of them only in part, but thank you for that. Madam Chair, in respect of the outstanding amount, the 356 million, which the Honourable Breitenbach has also referred to, and which I think, by way of not contradicting her, we've sort of already established that it's in arrears with more than the 90 days. I just want to ask another question. It was said that this is 43 institutions or departments which owns this amount. Then on average it will be 8 million, but obviously not all will be 8 million. So it would be good to hear whether what the biggest amounts owed are and which departments or entities is it to give the portfolio committee a better understanding of what is at play here. Then, Madam Chair, related to that, this issue of the new approach, the letters of demand, and then Treasury also adding their voice by way of a letter of demand, and I want to comment on whether my analysis of this approach is correct, in that the way I perceive this is that Treasury hopefully sees this as a interim or additional attempt to make the current system work, but hopefully there is an understanding that if this is not successful, then the what was referred to as the centralization of funds, or I think previously when you appeared in front of the portfolio committee, the question was asked, why can't Treasury, before paying out to departments and institutions whatever grants they might receive, ring fence whatever is owed to the SIU and pay directly to the SIU. So please allay my fear that this is not the final arrangement, but an attempt to see whether the ultimate maybe harsher measures can be avoided. And if so, what then are the timelines agreed with Treasury as to when will we, you and them agree that, okay, even your letters of demand is not bearing fruit? Then, Madam Chair, the Honourable Breitema has already referred to the targets not achieved, and I must say, even despite the whole page dedicated to explaining to us why the worrying thing, for the simple reason that if we cut to the bone, this is really the one thing that's within the exclusive domain of the SIU. So it's all well and fine to exceed targets in respect of referring matters to the NBA and so on and so on, and we're glad that that's happening. But the essence of the existence of the SIU is to claim back through civil litigation what has been lost from the public purse. And for that reason, Madam Chair, I think we must ask whether it is not defeating the purpose of the existence of this institution to downgrade those specific targets. I mean, the top risk you identify yourself for the institution is the inability to achieve targets. But I want to comment and say that, you know, rather if we have higher targets and it's missed annually by 10%, it would be better than to cut down the targets and maybe say, okay, we've met them. If we are serious about the core existence or the core reason for the existence of the SIU. So that's just by way of a comment, and maybe you can reply to that. Then, Madam Chair, my last question or comment is in respect of the 300 million rand of which the further actions is on hold pending an appeal in respect of the I would presume the constitutionality of certain actions of the AFU. And I just want to also understand where is this 300 million rand situated? Because if there's a strong case that if it was not for the appeal, action would have been taken, then the question might be asked whether the SIU has contemplated at least then trying to get a, well, I don't want to even use the word freezing order because that's AFU talk, but at least try and put a hold on this money, freeze it somewhere, just pending the appeal at least. Because my fear is just that if we are to wait for all appeals to be exhausted and this 300 million rand can be laundered 50 times, rolled over 100 times, and the recovery then would be virtually impossible if we just wait for the appeal. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Khan. Honourable Maila.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thanks, Advocate TV and Team SIU for the presentation. Madam Chair, indication is made here that the SIU has the power to prosecute. I just want clarity on your power to prosecute. Is it similar to private prosecution? How is the NPA involved when you have to prosecute? Just want clarity. And the other issue I want clarity on is the status of your remedial action. We have to go to the court so that at last we have to be convinced that the powers of the remedial action of the public protector are binding. So what is the status of the remedial action of the SIU? Do we need to go to the court to be clarified? There is also the issue of the organizational review. No, the process of the organizational review can make or break an organization. Now, my concern here is on the involvement of the special organized man. In your presentation, Advocate, you just touched, it was as if it was just a just want to know the involvement, the real involvement. there is also the issue of how you also contribute towards alleviating youth unemployment. I would like to know what your target are. Do you have specific on maybe procreation, maybe learnerships, whatever, all those programs? Do you have certain numbers that you can also means that you want the public to have increased awareness on the work of the SIE. Now, my clarification question is on what strategies are you employing to make sure that that is achieved? What is your footprint countrywide in ensuring that this is achieved? Who are your key stakeholders that are involved in this process? Lastly, Chair, I'm happy that you were able to indicate how we deal with employment equity. It's quite pleasing, but I just wanted clarity on people with disabilities. Do you meet the set type of disability, or what is the issue? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Maida. Honourable Matthias.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Look, let me also join my colleagues in welcoming the discussion. It's been very extensive. And appreciate that it's been presented in a manner which one can describe as being candid, truthful, and straightforward. And perhaps this also enables the head of the unit, enables the head of the unit to familiarize himself and also the report by himself in detail, so that he gets into the mix of the business and the amount of work that lies ahead of him. It's actually very seldom that a report of this nature is presented by the head itself or herself, but we appreciate the candidness with which the report has been prepared and presented. However, I must mention, Madam Chair, that in your absence, if you are with me, I don't know who's on the chair. Maybe Honourable Reisenbach was seated on the chair. That, look, where the tipping point, given the analysis presented here in the report. And why am I saying we're at a tipping point? Is that we seem not to be doing any breakthrough or causing any dent on the public perception that generally the state and government and everyone else is but commissioning of corruption, maladministration, fraud, and all of that. So we look the same, all of it. And that has got to do with the diminishing public trust and confidence in government, in public institutions, all of it, including parliament. Why are we at a tipping point? Because the very NDP that many embrace, except for the EFF, defines our public space as highly toxic, in that it's
toxic as a result of the perception of corruption. And it defines this corruption in the public space, which is so toxic, as a result of, I quote, the misuse of an official position for private gain. And the NDP further said that because of his perception, he is further undermined the state legitimacy, further erodes public trust and confidence in the state and its organs and institutions, and weakens public service. So the question is the SIU geared towards turning the situation around, to lift us from the tipping point, remove us from this toxic public perception about the state? I must hasten to make some few points. Well, I will not deal with other figures already. My colleagues here, with the vast experience that they have gained over the years of being members of parliament, they will deal with specific cents and rents and millions that have been not accounted for, that have gone through the cracks, stolen or misappropriated and all of that, but deal with the general. But I wonder whether the SIU is geared towards fighting and taking us from the tipping point. You describe yourself, I don't know if that pay line, what is it, the motto is still there, poised to strike. Is it still there? Do you use it?
Yes.
But I don't see it on your slide. Poised to strike. Perhaps you have lost confidence in how you describe in your own motto. Why is it not displayed there? Perhaps you are no longer poised to strike. And you must tell us why you have lost faith and trust in your own motto. Is it still there? Is you get towards and poised to strike? Do you got the necessary corruption prevention capacity? How many investigators do you have? Are they trained in forensic and other forms of sophisticated forms of investigation? Your slides on human resource doesn't show the skills required and the skills acquired already in various fields of your work. So that when you present the request before us for further budget allocation, is on the basis of what you are able to deliver. It's on the basis of you being able to demonstrate that you have the necessary current, the necessary capacity to fight and prevent corruption. Again, I want to know what has happened to your motto, poised to strike. You're also making a point here about the re-establishment of the special tribunal. I want to know what happened to, if ever there was such a special tribunal, what happened to its existence? Why has it been discontinued? The reason should, of course, be provided so that we are on the same page with all of you. I read the necessity and why it's so critical that the special tribunal must be re-established. You are further asking for amendments to the SIU Act. Do you have already some ideas which you have teased out about the proposed amendment? What specific areas would you want to see such amendments, and for what? I've realized that there is a lacuna in the current SIU Act, in the sense that I would highlight only two areas. One, that there is no legal obligation on the president to implement or abide by the findings of the SIU. And if that is indeed the case, then there is a serious problem. So it means all what you do effort and the money that the public, the taxpayers' money, which is invested in Norway, can be in vain if after you have done everything, after you have found or granted proclamations which are also signed by the president, before you can even act on any investigation, and everything else has been done, it would then mean that if the president has got no obligation whatsoever to implement or abide by your findings, then all of the efforts will be in vain. I find that as a serious matter. Secondly, SIU has got no control over the number, and this is also what your own observation, no control over the number and timing of approval proclamations. So if we don't have any control of that, and because the control lies elsewhere in the president, then I find that as a serious lacuna in the SIU Act. And what is it that you intend to do with all of these witnesses in the current legislation? And how do you hope to overcome them? We may, of course, be sitting here and lament about all of this, but if we choose to do nothing and not to support you, provided you're going to present before us the proposed amendment, we may be sitting here lamenting and do nothing, but that would be at our own peril. I want you to ask, this will be one of the two last points, Mr. Chair. You are giving us a list of investigations, what we say as a summary of civil claims and contracts and the like. You are not telling us about any endeavors or attempts whatsoever to venture into private sector. For instance, there are several cases which we have been referred to, one of which was the proclamation signed by the president to investigate the construction industry around corruption in the construction industry, price fixing and collusion. At what time are you going to dedicate time, resources and everything to venture into the private sector so that we do away with the perception that it's as if all of those who are critical about the government are only focusing on government and its focus, and we tend to forget about the private sector. And you seem to be confirming that in the manner in which you do your work, in the manner in which you report to Parliament. What is it that you can do? We'll be pleased if tomorrow or any other time when you come to appear before this committee, also in detail, list number of investigations into the private sector and the success rate or lack of thereof in that regard. Look, I also welcome the candidness with which you report and present before us the risk areas. And we hope going forward, with the support of the portfolio committee, you'll do everything in your power, of course, we'll be willing to act with you as willing partners to help you overcome the risk areas and strengthen your hand in fighting corruption. I want to make a final comment about human resources. I missed the page. It's on the demographics. The demographics of your human resource or personnel. I'm a little bit worried about the representation of the. Or before I deal with that, I'm happy that for a change you are not referring to people of my skin as black. You are referring to them as African. I'm very pleased with that change. And please talk to your colleagues everywhere else in government that they must desist from referring to people of my skin as black or not black. I'm an African. So that's the point I wanted to make. I'm not happy with the representation of color, what we refer to as color, women or female, in terms of your structure here, in terms of employment equity, demographics. Women, colored women are about two in your organization. I think that must change. For now, they are less represented in terms of your demographics. We need to see them growing up in the organizational hierarchy so that we are truly a representative of all our people. I think those are the few points I want to make. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Honorable Matthias. Honorable Swartz.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the very in-detailed presentation. And I also thank you, Advocate Matiba. I'm trying to elevate myself above the specific presentation, but I'll get to some specifics. But what we have to see, and I think the Honourable Sam Matthiasen made some good points, except I'd like to add to what he said at the end, for black Africans, if you add from now on white Africans as well. That's just in a lighter note.
Well, that would be a problem.
No, well, I'm not
either African or white. You can't be both.
You can. I'm a white African.
Yes.
So let's just leave it at that, Chair. That was mentioned in a lighter note. But I think I want to just take you back a couple of years when the Honourable Willie Hofmeyr appeared before the committee and he was head of SIU. And I asked him a question about the extent of corruption in the country. His answer was, corruption, fraud, and irregular expenditure then, it's a good 8-10 years ago, was 30 billion rand a year. You'll remember that, as good as I. Now we sit in, 7 years later, that figure is still bandied about, and I'm sure that it is far bigger because we know our national budget is in excess of a trillion rand. So you fully appreciate, Advocate Matiba, the crucial role that the unit plays. And that's why I've always supported the unit. I've always encouraged it. When we looked at your modeling, your financing model, the previous amendment, we raised the concern, what if the departments don't pay? And National Treasury and other members, and I understand you were looking at ways, and now we're sitting with that exact same problem. The departments are not paying. And that undermines your whole work. And so I fully have an appreciation for the fact. But it seems to me that when you look, people are marching in the streets at the moment about corruption. There's a massive, right up to the presidency, concerns about corruption. There is, in my view, there's an unwillingness by certain local, national and provincial departments to act against corruption, maladministration and malpractice. When you see that they're not prepared to, and it's an easy way. So you can't investigate us, we're not paying you, therefore you can't do your work. And I've said it in a number of budget votes across the board in different departments. I've had the Minister of Public Works has agreed with me. I've said, give the SIU more capacity, give them 500 million. They can collect 30 billion because that's our fiscal shortfall for the year. Is about 30 billion. So the work that you do together with the Hawks, together with the NPA, AFU, is crucial because you can balance the books. It's a straightforward thing. But what disturbs me is that last year you were only able to collect 73 million. 73 million, when we're looking at a figure in excess of 30 billion. Now there are lots of explanations for that. And yes, you've avoided 3.8 billion and 4 billion values of contracts where you've done very, very well. But when you look at that figure, 73 billion,
$73 million that was actually collected, then I'm afraid we are not winning. And as advocate, as Honourable McKay said, the tipping point that Advocate Madonsela previously said, the tipping point of corruption, we are not making any progress in our fight. And so I think, Chair, we need to look holistically. And I need to start asking, because you correctly focused that the profiles of investigations changes. So therefore, it's not correct to look at targets and things like that. But I wanted to give you that sketch, because I've been in this committee the longest serving member. I am your strongest supporter. But it is also looking at where are we. Now, you did an investigation into, let's look at specifics, because I would think, and this is your challenge, I want to hear from you, pre-proclamation investigation. You did an extensive investigation into Eskom. That report is about to come out. You investigated coal contracts, you investigated a number of other issues. The procurement of coal supplies, the procurement of coal transportation services up to February 2012. Now we're sitting with the Gupta-related companies with the same issues. Is it not possible to extend your investigations into those areas as well? You're about to present, according to your annual report, your findings on those contracts, which would be up to 2012. But it's exactly the same issues. When we had the Nkandla issue, the public protector brought out its binding recommendations. At the same time, you were able to do your especially your SIU report. Now we're sitting with the public protector's report into state capture of state-owned companies. Is it not possible for you already to be investigating and following up on those issues? Because that's where the billions of rands lie. That's the big issues. I sat on the ad hoc committee on the SABC. The SIU did an investigation into the SABC. Wonderful work. But we're sitting with the same issues again. The same issues are now highlighted by a report that the whole of Parliament accepted into the SABC. The SAA, now the public protector, is doing the same issues. So, Chair, I need to hear, Advocate Matiba, whether you can not, because of the crucial role you play. And this, here we're talking, here's the billions of rands here. The National Treasury stopped a contract the other day, 4 billion rand. You've got the ability. You've got the ability. And it is crucial. But the challenge is, you are reliant on proclamations by the presidency, and there are questions around the presidency himself. And so the people in this are asking us, what are you doing as members of parliament? What are you doing as organizations? Why? We don't see any investigations against Gupta-owned companies. What is going on there? There are complaints laid. There are criminal charges laid. We don't see any. There's 73, the Financial Intelligence Center Act is one of the acts you are required to investigate and look into as well. There's 73 suspicious transactions related to Gupta-related companies. Is it within your domain to start investigating those? You see, so this is where you can play, and I don't want to only, I'm just using those as examples of the massive amounts of the billions of rands, where we're talking of in excess of a trillion rand of our national budget. And so we need to find a way to assist you to do your work quicker. One of the issues that comes up is the civil litigation that you are embarking on. Now again, surely, Chairperson, when we meet with the Chief Justice, we should say, but when it comes to these corruption matters that are evolving, they should be expedited. Why are they waiting 2 years down the line? And I understand, I'm a lawyer, I'm an attorney, I understand that there are constraints. You've got constraints with court dates, you've got constraints. Now, we thought that the special tribunal being set up would expedite that, but now the judge presidents are saying, no, you can't interfere with my court role. But that's going to defeat the whole purpose, in my respectful view. So we, as Parliament, need to engage the Chief Justice again and say, but here is an SIU unit that is trying to do their work, but at every level they are being stymied with finances, with court dates, with, you work through the state attorney's office, we know all the challenges around the state attorney. And so, Chair, we all have got a passion because we understand where we are headed with this corruption that is becoming massive, and the SIU can play a crucial role in this regard. Chair, just one or two specific further issues relates to the acknowledgement of debt enforcement department at the SIU. Where you could, now, you see, the SIU, you had the SASA massive investigations there. Billions of rands. AODs are signed. You've got your own SIU unit that collects, but then I presume most of those, for example, SASA, goes back to the department. Are they ever followed up? Do those people follow up? Your other challenge, why we, when we drafted the legislation so long ago, was to be able to allow you, through the asset forfeiture unit, to get quick asset forfeiture. Now there's a problem there. We know the asset forfeiture, there is problems with that unit besides the court dates, besides the appeals. So you've also been stymied there. Because you don't want to sit, you have a lengthy investigation of 5 years, you bring out your report, then you go to court and you start, you get a decision on the merits that the contract should never have been awarded. Then you've got to go back to court a year, 2 years later on the quantum. That can't be right. Because you're going to take 7 years, that company is a shell by that time. We know that's what happened. They will liquidate that company. So by the time we want to collect the money's not there. That's why we said let's use the asset forfeiture unit. Go quickly, get the money as much as possible. So we need to take a step back. And I thank you, Advocate Ntiba, because I think that's what you're doing. You're assessing the root causes. But we as Parliament need to step up to the plate and assist you. Because, Chairperson, it's in our research documents for a department not to pay the SIU. It is a breach of the Public Finance Management Act. It's a breach. There's misconduct, but not one Director General has ever been charged, ever, for a breach of the Public Finance Management Act. So it's a very easy way of undermining your work. Come and do the investigation. We're not paying you. That's half your budget gone. You can't do your work. You come to us and ask for more money. We said, but they're not paying you. It's like a vicious circle. And so it's unfair for us to blame you for not doing your work properly when the money's not available, when departments aren't paying their accounts to you. But Chair, that is what I'd just like you, I've made a number of comments, but I'd like you to just comment as far as you can, specifically on the state-owned companies, on whether you are able to extend your previous, like in Eskom in particular, where you've got an existing proclamation, and to what degree, when you read something in the newspaper and you say, oh, here's a massive issue, are you able, from a pre-proclamation stage, to go and investigate those, whether they talk about last week it was a billion rand at Eskom again. Surely there must be some mechanism to enable us to fight this corruption. But thank you from my side, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Swart. Honourable Bongo.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Chairperson. Set up
discussing of the issues around the MOUs with other stakeholders. I just want to know that in terms of this plan that you've given us, how far are we in terms of those MOUs? Because you will not be able to execute this web alone other than that. But and second to that, how did you plan to fix the overlaps on issues that overlap to other institutions like public content and so on, and how do we as a committee assist you around those issues? Then the other issue, the anti-corruption task. Your participation in the anti-corruption task. What support do you need from the committee in terms of a legislative mandate towards making sure that that issue gets to be a method that is prioritized? And it's good that you that in your 10 months in office is an unqualified report. That is very positive from our side. Now, you've raised a matter about the pre-proclamation. Does that flow from the legislative mandate? Because I hear now you say it attracts a lot of funding from your side. I think we'll have to look at that. I agree with Honorable Matthijs about the issue that in this country, everyone, when he wants to discredit the next one, speaks about corruption. When a person does not like you, you say you're corrupt, and then everyone starts to believe that as if it's the truth. So I want to know that how far in terms of creating awareness the public, but secondly, making sure that we have a structural way of dealing with this issue of corruption, whether it's perceived or it's real, but we've got to get closer to it so that we don't just confuse the people of this country that corruption, but we need to go closer because as far as I'm concerned, we have powerful institution of the state who can deal with this matter or come closer to it. And SIU is one of them. I see here, like Honorable Matthijs say that post strike. I wanted to ask the exact question because when I see there, I see a snake and it's post. And once you're posed, it must sting. So, the extent your plans in terms of ensuring that you really do the work as far as it is done. But of interest, many people in this country is around the use of land, investigation. Special investigation around the issue of land, because there is a lot of land which is sitting in the hands of the private individuals and private companies. To what extent in your plans can we incorporate that we attend to the issue of land, we investigate, but the land finally can be taken back to the people where it belongs to. Another matter for the canvas, which I agree with, the getting into the private sector, because when we speak about corruption, we always speak about government departments and so on. But the extent to which the private sector is being investigated, because you remember during the World Cup, we were told that 5 big companies were involved in serious corruption. So these pre-proclamation issues, they must also get closer to those kind of people. And now we're told that banks are colluding and there's a report by the Competition Commission. So I just want to find out how can your plan accommodate some of these issues. Because we'll tend to look at government when the whole money is in the hands of the private sector. And one other issue which is linked to the work that we're doing. Here you're saying, you spoke about leases. An amount of about 7 million has been mentioned, 7 million. So I think we may have to liaise with the DOJ, because there are a lot of public buildings that we person refurbish and use them because they are public property. We have a lot of savings around the issue of lease. I think as part of your plans going forward, we need to look at that so that we save the cost. You raised the matter about the 300 million. So I want to know how long has been that money being freezed and so on. Because we've got to look at this turnaround strategy in terms of making sure that we don't keep this money freezed for such a long time. These monies may also be used. Maybe if they've been freezed, they may also be taken back to the way that they're doing. If they are properly acquired. Then the other matter, I hear that you're saying you were busy with the remodeling organizational review process. I just want us to look at that, the clear plans, and how do you want to do it, because you must be very clear on that, because I see a lot of money also that you have, your budget is it's about payment of the staff complement. So how is that remodeling exercise going to assist in terms of reduction in this organizational review process that we are getting into? Lastly, Chair, is about the issue of the payments for the sector departments. I think I agree with Honorable Schwartz that the breach of the Public Finance Management Act. What are your plans in terms of having to take actions? Because this is a legislative mandate, and I want to know how much is it involved exactly that must be paid. And what are your suggestions that the committee may have to assist you with so that you're able to get this relevant money?
Thank you very much. Let me also take the opportunity of taking the presentation, elaborate very clear, and just to indicate that when you mentioned challenges, the organizational structure, turnaround time, effectiveness in supply chain management, operational excellence, how it is strengthened, and how to recover speed. What is important also sometimes is to articulate what you intend to strategy to deal with the challenges so that they don't remain challenges forever. And when it comes to the fees, I'm thinking that you really need to engage training so that you come with a model that will actually work for you. Because there comes time when Treasury has got money or these departments, they're going to give it out. And maybe if you come up with something, some form of arrangement with Treasury, that money might actually come from Treasury straight to you. It might actually quickly solve the problem. One thing that you need to actually also understand is that as South Africans, there is this quest for fighting corruption. And this is why when you come here, to some extent, sometimes you'll actually start thinking that we think you're not doing your work. We've been on a unit over a number of years. We've seen how it has actually been growing. And we appreciate it for what it is. Some of the things might actually be the same reason, same bad, like the Honorable Swart saying. But I think with the same breath, we need to actually also talk about your successes, which are actually noticeable. And of course, there will be areas that maybe individually, as members of parliament, will be concerned about, like the whole issue of approach that deals also with the private sector. Because, you know, in South Africa, when people talk about corruption, there is ability to clearly articulate corruption in government. But we don't have the same ability of articulating corruption in the private sector. And remember, if there is corruption in the private sector, so now we're grappling with economic transformation. Those are some of the things that will actually not make it possible for economic transformation to actually take place, to allow the economy of the country to benefit the majority of the people in this country. But at the same time, remember there are other institutions like the Competition Commission, where there's monopoly, where there are cartels, where there is collusion within the business sector. The Competition Commission is there. And this is why we keep on also throwing in the whole issue of the banks that were actually colluding to bring down the rent. But maybe what you need to do is to look at how you actually work with these institutions, lest we find that we actually venture into mandates that are outside our scope. You talked about the special tribunal, re-establishment of the special tribunal is a good idea. But what is worrying is what you actually anticipate as problematic in terms of the controls. And I think maybe you need to actually engage with the Chief Justice on it, so that it does not become a problem. We don't want to come up with strategies that we already think that they will actually become problematic. When I'm looking at your organizational structure, we can see that you've actually improved when it comes to appointment of females, but I see a lot of semi-skills under female still. And I don't know whether that's because it's females who agree to be appointed at that level, or they come unskilled and therefore can, you know, semi-skilled and therefore can only occupy those positions. It's something that needs to be considered, so that it shouldn't actually lead to a situation that we are normally used to, that in a company where there's somebody who's going to serve tea must be a woman, as if it's only women that can actually be appointed at that level. So something that needs to be looked at so that you can be in the position to improve on that area. In terms of your targets for the coming years, you have indicated that, for example, in 2017-18, in terms of continuous reports, you're looking at 800, and then it goes 1,000, 1,200. But I'm looking at continuous reports, then it comes to 5 and 6. What does that mean? Does it mean that we find it difficult to conclude the report, or we actually end up closing files because maybe what is in the files doesn't really boil down to something that can be finally concluded? If you can just clarify that. Do you ever get false disclosures for whistleblowers? Then they say this direction, there's corruption, corruption, and you run in that direction, and you find that there's absolutely nothing. When we are actually dealing with a bill that protects whistleblowers, we have actually insisted that we actually insert within that bill action that needs to be taken when there is false disclosure, because it doesn't only damage the reputation of people, it actually becomes expensive. If an institution like yours has got to be told that there is corruption inside, and you do a whole lot of investigation and there's absolutely nothing, then there's got to be a way of actually managing to deal with a situation of that nature. But the question that I'm asking is, do you ever find that some of the disclosures are false? Thank you. Can we get a response from the unit?
Thank you, Chair, and honourable members. We appreciate all your questions, and we'll go through them meticulously. On the
outstanding data.
line which is actually the company. There's actually there's a dependency on those two indicators. And the actual money last year was 52. But if you look at the previous line, that really indicates that this is the picture that I wanted to just state to the committee, that when we refer to the profile of the cases, previous, when the target was developed or was put together, it was in line with the proclamation and the nature of proclamations that are in the in current investigation. So we have sat down when we did the strategy, and I mean I challenged my colleagues to say out there the public and our public representatives. Parliament, as you correctly stated today, that those are but one of the key indicators that we get measured on. You know, how effectively do we go out there and recover monies to the state? But Chair, without belaboring the point, we have taken into account that at a realistic level, if you look at what we have recovered last year and this year, and I still said that this would still be audited, but these are really pretty much accurate numbers, projections. On the first one, value of money and assets potential recovery. By quarter four, we're sitting at 54 million. And the value of money actually recovered. We're sitting at 90. But again, this is the work of, as we did the analysis, the money that's sitting as part of the AFU process, had it not been for the holdup because of the appeal process, that money could probably have come out and added on. But if you also go forward and look at the year-to-date actuals, that's when you then see improvements. Because as we did the report, we then wait for the data to come in. You see the year-to-date actual on the value of money and or assets potentially recoverable. It then goes up to 126 million, right? And the money the value of money or assets recovered goes up to 32 million. So this indicates that data either from NPA or from other areas, you know, keeps coming in. We unfortunately have to deal with the cutoff of the year end. Where we really have to cut off and say, you know, we draw the line. And the line will probably be drawn at the year-to-date actuals, you know, which gives us 126 on the first one and 32 million on the next one. So when we reviewed this, Chair, we said, you know, given all the changes, you know, the changing in profiles of cases, the constraints that we have in terms of the civil litigation process, which doesn't really, you know, allow us to convert the monies, the equitable adjustments into the actual money, and some of these processes that we already indicated, what would be the reasonable or the realistic figure. And we did agree that although it's still very steep in terms of 17-18 when it's from 240 to 200 and from 140 to 120. We would like to, this is almost like still a work in progress, kind of seeing at what stage do we pack our recoveries. You know, we are mindful that this is one of the critical indicators that we are measured on. But we would like to appeal to the committee that if we then have the special tribunal in place, we process through, you know, our pre-proclamation activities so that we can turn them around appropriately. We also organizationally, you know, jack up some of the processes. What is it that those will spin out as benefits to our capability to deal? But we are of the view that we have to work even harder to ensure that we even meet the targets that have been depicted in 17-18. And these are dependent on some of these measures. That's why we need to drive hard particularly on the special tribunal. Because if you see those figures that are reported, the values attendant to the civil matters, those are quite big figures. If we then succeed, which I hope we will, in re-establishing the special tribunal, that should then give us a sense of how quick then the civil process would turn around, and then that would give us a good measure of where is it that we put our targets. I found out from my colleagues who have been around longer than myself, the science behind the target setting has really been only focused around the nature of proclamations that we get. So there are other variables now that we're putting in place here and saying the one variable is to improve the civil process. The other variable is to then jack up on our own internal mechanisms. So we are at a stage where we are trying to really perfect the science of setting the target. So it hasn't really been sort of thumbstuck as one would say, but as I say, it's been focused only on the nature of the proclamation that we are under investigating, and then didn't take into account the other variables. That is the challenge that we have. So we are really ensuring that we come to a realistic manner of determining the time. So, Chair, that's the extent to which I can go in saying the 240, I mean the 200 and the 120, we should be in a position where we come back here on the next occasion if we are to account on this 17-18 target. Ensure that the processes that we have put in place have actually, you know, produced the results that we anticipate, and we have either made, you know, a big, huge improvement in meeting the target. At the moment, the target, the science, as I say, behind setting the target, you know, was not informed by all the variables, which is problematic. Spent quite a while on explaining that here, so that we're on one page. MOU with NPA, and maybe I should cover the other role players as well. We have an MOU which is almost finalized with the NPA. We should be signing it into next week. Yesterday I was on the line with the NDPP, just to establish when, because we've toed and froed on the versions of the MOUs, in particular on the deliverables within the MOU, because we're going to monitor it and ensure that we live by the targets that are in there. Mainly, and I know that we'll be doing this on the next occasion when we appear in terms of performance. The appeared, we showed that there's quite a number of referrals that we've made to the NPA, and the machine has really been, you know, not turning as quickly as we would like. So that MOU is going to help us to measure that space. The MOU with the NPA, with the public protector, we started that process, and Honorable Bongo, you did ask in terms of managing the overlaps. In particular, when I met with the public protector, we are specifically going to determine, because both of our legislations say if SIU is of the view that this matter can best be handled by the public protector, refer it, and the other way around. So we want to make sure that we determine a clear criteria that would say at what point and why and how do you refer the matter. So we will deal with those overlaps. But of importance is that we want to also deal with the situation where we don't do duplicate. And that's very important. I'll probably come back to that one. How do I expect that the strategy will help to improve the work of SIU? When we set on, I mean, it's really part of my responsibility to ensure that we put SIU on a trajectory that will perform as expected. And when we set a senior management team, led by myself, obviously, we reviewed where we are and how is it that we need to improve and what's required. So this strategy takes into account some of those measures that need to be done, and I am satisfied that if this strategy is executed appropriately, we should be able to see that improvement. Honorable Horton, outstanding among 43 institutions. I think I did indicate that we will send the list with the details. The interaction with National Treasury, whether it's interim, why don't we centralize? I think I did indicate that it's two-pronged at the moment. We're dealing with the current situation where we have to put pressure by sending letters and ensuring that they pay, but the sustainable one would be to where we include our proposal in the legislation and ensuring that we work with Treasury to centralize one way or another, you know, this budget, and that would be the sustainable solution.
The time that has actually been set aside for your presentation is just 5 minutes. We have another presentation. But what it means is that for all the other comments, you can actually put them in writing. So I'm giving you the last 5 minutes to just touch on what you think is important.
Yes. Let me just touch on the SOEs. Honorable Swart mentioned a critical point. Just to indicate that we have sought to also improve on how proactive we become, so that we shouldn't be sitting back and waiting for allegations to be referred. Where we become aware that SIU can also add value in a specific area, we do take the initiative. For example, we took it upon ourselves and read through the ad hoc parliamentary committee on SABC. I read it page by page, paragraph by paragraph. I saw where SIU can play a role. But the ad hoc committee specifically enjoins the interim board to do forensic investigations in certain areas. So then we met with the interim committee, with the interim board, and they wrote me a letter that says the board has resolved that they want to sort of engage SIU services. So we're meeting them on Monday to say, you know, how is it that we can assist them, bearing in mind that they are in place for 6 months, and they want, and this is really going to be a test case. I said to my colleagues that this is a test case to see how speedily can we turn around our investigations, starting from proclamation. I have engaged Justice, I've engaged the President to say, you know, we are meeting SIPC on Monday, we'll put together a proclamation motivation. If need be, we will walk that motivation through the corridors in Justice and the President to get it signed. But that's really with the quest of making sure that we turn it around quickly. So we will be involved there out of our own initiative. Where we've had proclamations running, ESCOM, for example, ESCOM, if we have issued a report and there's new allegations that come up, we are able indeed to ask for the extension of the proclamation and investigate the new allegations. On the state capture report, the committee would be aware that that was the work done by the public protector, and in the quest of the relationship that we have, if the public protector is of the view that some of the matters that come out of there should be referred to SIU or the other way around, I'm sure they will exercise that that option to do so. Chair, the other critical one, obviously, the re-establishment of the special tribunal. Honorable Matthias did raise a question. Why was it stopped? Why did it not function? And my information that the last time it functioned was, the last time the special investigation functioned was what, more than 10 years ago? You know, and I also obviously wanted to understand why is it that it was, you know, not continued and so on. It appears that there were sort of technicalities that legal practitioners would raise, you know, around some of the rules of the court and so on. And it obviously, you know, didn't, you know, receive the attention such that it comes back again. So we are making sure now that when we reestablish it, we are also going to develop the court rules that deals with those issues that were raised at the time to try to block the effectiveness of the special tribunal.
Private sector,
yes. That's another important aspect here. I think there was reference on the construction industry. We've done, yes, we'll come to that as well. We've done a comprehensive investigation of the construction industry, particularly around the CIDB, you know, which falls under the DPW Public Works. And we have made significant findings to date. The report will still obviously be prepared to the President, but as in line with what I said before, we found that the officials that have made themselves guilty of misconduct, and we have referred them to the board. We've sat down with the board. We have really encouraged the board to ensure that they take action. With regard to the banks, Chairperson, it is our intention to also go and interact with the Competition Commission, like we do with other law enforcement. I mean, we've said a few weeks back with the Council for Medical Scheme, for example, because there's a whole lot of corruption or irregularities happening in the medical industry by private entities. We would want to make sure that we collaborate with the likes of Medical Council for Medical Scheme, for they are the regulators in that space. And we have agreed that we will also go into an MOU. They will refer matters to us. Where, remember, our mandate, we follow public money. If it has disappeared into the private sector, we do make sure that we follow it with the relevant other regulators. So with the bank, we'll probably do the same where the Competition Commission has done its work. Similar to the CMS Council for Medical Schemes, we'll sit down with the Competition Commission. If there are elements of corruption which they have not looked at, we will ensure that those matters are referred to us, and we look at them. You know, so we do interact with various regulators. So I'd like to ensure the committee that, and for example, in our investigations, If we find that more often a contract would be awarded to a private sector company, you know. For example, in the public workspace, the leases, some of the landlords would be private companies and so on. We don't relent in ensuring that we follow up and ensure that the private sector also is held accountable. And we are going to continuously improve in that space. In the ACTT space, we also want to ensure that we put this on the agenda so that ourselves, HOCS, NPA, we are relentless in ensuring that we also hold private sector accountable.
Thank you very much. Let me take the opportunity of thanking your advocate and TV and the team for presenting to us the annual budget and annual performance for 2017-2018. And may I then say that this phase of the meeting is closed. We will proceed with business members.
Thank you.
Yes, we can have 3 minutes to come back.